Omaha Public Radio presents another lecture program from Creighton University on Noon Forum. We'll hear the first of three programs recorded at the 13th Asian Culture Week, presented annually by the Asian World Center at Creighton. Today's guest speakers will be Adel Salazar, an East-West graduate student in the Asian World Center, and Maorang Zhang, the director of the Asian World Center. They'll speak on the topics Official Religious Policy in China and Eyewitness Reality of the Chinese Muslims Practicing Islam in Communist China. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday afternoon, April 18, 2017, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of Creighton University, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Jinmei Yuan, the Director of East-West Studies, the Director of the Philosophy for Children Program, and a professor in the Department of Philosophy at Creighton University.
For today's talk, Dr. Maorang Zhang will talk about the religion policy in China briefly. And then Adel Salazar will talk about his research in China in the summer with the East-West Study Program in a Muslim village. Let me introduce Adel Salazar first. Adel obtained his bachelor degree of history with a minor in Asian Studies from Creighton University in 1916. He will complete his master program in East-West Studies from Creighton in 2017. Salazar is taking a gap year before pursue a PhD in International History or Asian Studies and plan to become a college professor and hold a political office. And this is a former introduction to Adel. I would add some personal introduction to Adel. Adel went to China with me, and he did this research. He does not know Chinese that well, but he has this common language to communicate with not only Chinese, but also Chinese Muslim. He smiled to everybody. He got detailed information from aged people and from young. From my information, I knew he made good friends with Chinese Muslim. He still communicate with those people in China. So I pretty much sure the story he's going to tell us is his experience and some insight information nobody else can get. For Maorang, Dr. Zhang is associate professor of political science and international relations and the director of Asian World Center at Creighton. Previous this job, Dr. Zhang graduated from University of Hawaii, and he has been running East Asian Study Asian Culture Week for many years. He also was the International Visitor Leadership Program in the U.S. Department of State of Bureau of Education and Cultural Affairs, and participate in the East-West Center's Asian-Pacific Leadership Program. Dr. Zhang has been with Creighton since 2004, teaching Asian Studies, Political Science, and International Relations. Thinks Dr. Zhang had experience working for Chinese Religion Bureau, so he has a pretty clear understanding of Chinese religion policy. Before we let Adel to do a demonstration, to do presentation on his topic, I would invite Dr. Zhang to introduce the Chinese policy in religions first.
I'm not surprised that Jimmy does not know my stories quite well. Good morning, everybody. I realize that my presentation is to present or provide a political background on the research that Adele did when he was in China. Since this is a background introduction, I would like to focus precisely on the official Chinese documents in either Chinese and English sources that are obtained through the website from the Chinese government website and also the embassy website in outside China. Before I do this, I would attest one impressive point that I am convinced that after all these years, since mid-90s, when I formally left the State Religious Affairs Bureau, China's top official agency in charge of the national religious affairs, the following quoted statements that I'm going to quote quite a lot, as official policy on Chinese religions have not been changed or have not changed at all. Despite the fact that so many, many things happened to China all these years. Now, one enlightening perspective occurs to me always that I always understand that China impresses changes. There is always a good reason for better change, to change things from good to better, from a different situation to accommodate the new changes. So two things remain taboo that have not been changed. One is the Communist Party leadership that you cannot really think of any changes. Second is the religious freedom policy. Without foreign religious impact or foreign interference cannot change, but that under the condition that Communist Party has to remain as the leader of the country. So against this background, with irony, two things that have been not changed, as I just elaborated, or other things that you can expect there is always change that occurs. You know, with that, I can go on with a few events that, you know, we think will not change but actually have been changed, like the Hong Kong takeover, like the Taiwan mainland China reunification thing, or even China's North Korean policy or bilateral relations, that even these things have been changed accordingly. Now let me focus to the business that I'm required to do for Mr. Salazar's presentation on China's Muslim. I'm going to quote, this is a large part of the quote that give you a very insightful policy that has been carried out since 1949. Quote, after the birth of New China in 1949, the Chinese government formulated and implemented the policy of religious freedom and established a new relationship between politics and relations in accordance with the actual condition of the country. Chinese citizens are free to choose and express their religious belief as well as demonstrate their religious status. All religions are equally and coexist harmoniously with one another, and there is so far no such thing as dispute among different religions. I continue to quote. Religious believers and non-believers also respect to each other and they live together peacefully. The Constitution of the People's Republic of China stimulates citizens of the People's Republic of China enjoy freedom of religion. No state organ, public organization, or individual may compel citizens to believe in or not to believe in
any religion, nor may they discriminate against citizens because they do or do not believe in religion. The state protects normal religious activities. The Constitution also stimulates nobody can make use of religion to engage in activities that disrupt social order, impair the health of citizens, and interfere with the educational system of the state. Religious organizations and religious affairs are not subject to any foreign dominance. Now, one more large quote. Many different laws in China, such as the National Regional Autonomic Law, Civil Law, Education Law, Labor Law, Compulsory Education Law, Electoral Law of People's Congress, Organic Law of Villagers, Committee and Advertisement Law, and so on, also stimulate citizens, no matter they are religious believer or not, enjoy the right of election and to be elected. Legitimate property of religious organizations is protected by law. Education system shall not be also interfered with religious interference. So this is the end of the quote. And I can go on, but one more important thing I would like to add, that if you're a Communist Party member, although you are a citizen of People's Republic of China, you are banned to believe in any religion. So that tells that the situation can be very different, that if you are in certain category, if you are different services. But on the whole, as I realize that Chinese Christianity, almost like from cross, is a cross sign to a T sign, that you don't have an extra point as you go beyond that cross. It has to follow the policy of the Chinese government, in which I understand in such a way that China has been a semi-colony of the imperialist past, and that make people strongly be aware that any foreign dominance will challenge the leadership of the Communist Party. So when we put things together, the two things that you don't see changes, that actually is one thing. As far as the legitimacy of the Communist Party remains in place, there is no such thing that you can obey someone beyond that party line. With that, I would like to welcome Mr. Salazar to present the a very unique situation of Chinese Muslims in a society where religious freedom is guaranteed and the Muslims have been a beneficiary of that policy. And that's a very different scenario as we see from countries such as the United States and other countries that you do not see that harmonious relations, in fact, there between the Muslims and the Muslim Chinese and the non-Muslim Chinese. So please welcome Mr. Adal Al-Salazar for presentation.
Imagine a country with the largest population in the world that claims to have over 5,000 years of continuous history with 56 recognized ethnic groups, each with their own unique language and culture. Imagine that this country has a strong central government with an army of bureaucrats and unelected politicians whom decide the policy for more than 1.3 billion people, including all of these different ethnic groups. Now imagine that this country claims to follow an egalitarian ideology in which all people are equal but are not allowed to practice their religion. How do believers practice their faith in a country that denounces religion as a superstition and a tool for the corrupt and powerful but remain loyal to their government? This country isn't imaginary. This country is the People's Republic of China. From June to August 2016, I traveled around China in an attempt to find out whether or not Muslims in China could freely and openly practice their religion of Islam under a communist government. Since China is a very large country, I chose two historically Muslim sites to conduct my research through interviews and observations: the Muslim quarter in the city of Xi'an and the village of Donglianhua in rural Yunnan. My methods to determine whether or not Muslims could practice their religion freely and openly was if they were able to fulfill the five pillars of Islam. The first pillar, Shahada, is their creed, which is the belief in only one God and Muhammad is his messenger. The next, Salah or Salat, is prayer is to be given to God or Allah five times a day. The third is Zakat or Zakah. It's the giving of alms or charity to the poor, which is usually 2.5% of your total income. Next, there is Sam or Siyam, or making the pilgrimage or Hajj to, or no, it's fasting. Fasting during sunrise and sunset during the month of Ramadan. And then finally, the last is Hajj, which is making pilgrimage to Mecca. Now, of course, there's no simple answer for a country as massive and diverse as China when conducting this research. I actually did not know that there had been Muslims in China for more than 1,000 years. As such, I always made sure to keep an open mind and maintain virtually no expectations about what I might find. The two areas that I focused my research on, the historic Muslim quarter of Xi'an and the remote Donglianhua village in Yunnan province, both have large populations of the Hui minority group, or Chinese Muslims, whom generally speak Mandarin as their mother tongue and practice Sunni Islam. However, both areas have been heavily commercialized within the past few years to cater to domestic and foreign tourism, further complicating my research as I struggled to find candidates willing to be interviewed as they feared not only for the safety of themselves and their families, but of their businesses as well. In preparation for my travel and research about Islam and Muslims in China, I had read that the Hui were not a homogenous group, adapting to whatever the dominant language and culture of wherever they settled. Another important distinction to point out is that most Hui live independently in either isolated villages or urban enclaves, which can be drastically different environments in China depending upon the local economy of the city or province. Given this information, I chose to study one group of Hui in the culturally diverse Donglianhua village in rural Yunnan province, and another group in the thriving Muslim quarter commercial district in the heart of Xi'an. The Hui people are the third largest recognized ethnic minority in China, practicing Sunni Islam and following the less stringent Hanafi school of jurisprudence. They are the second most numerous of the 10 recognized Muslim minorities, numbering a little less than half of China's 21.5 million Muslims, outnumbered only by the Turkic Uyghurs of Xinjiang in the northwest of the country. However, unlike the Uyghurs, the Hui can be found almost everywhere in China and are the largest urban ethnic minority in most of China's cities, including Beijing and Shanghai. Although they form a small overall percentage of the population, there are more Muslims in China than in every Middle Eastern Muslim country except for Iran, Turkey, and Egypt. Most Hui people closely resemble the Han Chinese, the majority of the population, than any of the other Muslim minorities in terms of physical characteristics, demographic proximity, and cultural assimilation, adapting many of their Islamic practices to Han ways of life, which has often been a source of criticism by more Orthodox-oriented Muslim reformers in and outside of China. One area that does require further clarification when defining the Hui is the label of Chinese-speaking Muslims or Chinese Muslims, as this is misleading since by law all Muslims living in China are born there are considered Chinese by citizenship. There are also large communities of Hui who speak non-Chinese languages instead of Chinese as their primary language due to their location, such as Tibetan, Uyghur, Mongolian, or Thai, learning to speak Mandarin only in school. The earliest Muslim communities in China are descended from a mixture of Arab, Persian, Central Asian, and Mongolian Muslim merchants, soldiers, and officials who originally settled in China's northwest provinces and along the southeast coast beginning in the 7th century. Traditional Chinese-style mosques resemble Confucian temples with sweeping roofs and symmetrical courtyards, lacking the iconic minarets of typical mosques in the Western Islamic world. With the recent war on terrorism, there's been a growing concern among the Chinese government on how to better integrate Muslims into Chinese society to prevent them from becoming a threat. The Chinese government has encouraged stronger relations between Muslims in China and Muslim countries, particularly the countries of the Middle East. Foreign delegations of Muslims regularly travel to prominent Islamic sites in China, like Donglianghua Village in Yunnan that I visited, which is actively promoted by the state as religious tourism, and donations are strongly encouraged. The Chinese government hopes that private Islamic investment and donations will assist economic development and foster good relations between China and Muslim countries. The vast majority of grants by visiting foreign Muslims have mostly been donated to the building and renovation of Islamic schools, mosques, and hospitals. Furthermore, China has been keenly aware of the importance of the treatment of its Muslim minorities as a key factor in its trade and diplomacy with foreign Muslim governments. The historic Hui village of Donglianghua is about an hour drive away from the more ancient and diverse city of Dali in western Yunnan province. Surrounding the ancient village is a modern city that is in the process of building numerous towering apartment complexes and factories, evident by the seemingly endless construction sites and advertisements to invest or to reserve your future home as soon as possible. The mosque I visited was in the center of the village, as it is in most Hui villages, and had I not seen the star and crescent moon atop the gate and on the tower in the courtyard of the mosque, I honestly would not have known that this was a mosque, as the architecture of the tower and prayer hall more closely resembled the Confucius Temple in Nanjing than it did of any mosque I'd ever seen. A mosque is a place of worship for Muslims to come together for prayer, as well as to serve various other functions for the Muslim community. Although the architectural style of mosques varies by regions, most mosques have at least one minaret, a tall, slender tower, usually used to call Muslims to prayer, and a dome above the prayer hall. The mosque in Donglianghua did not have a minaret per se, but it did have a bell tower in the center of the courtyard in front of the prayer hall that was architecturally similar to a Chinese pagoda with curved roofs, while the prayer hall was flat-roofed and rectangular. Before entering the courtyard, I had noticed that a shabby-looking policeman had followed my group from outside a restaurant to the mosque. Once inside the courtyard, the policeman went ahead of us and called up the stairs of a house next to the prayer hall and then left. An elderly man, dressed in black and wearing a white cap, appeared a few seconds later and walked over to introduce himself. To protect his identity, he will be referred to only as the imam. In Sunni Islam, an imam is the person who leads the prayer service. At this particular mosque, the imam also performed the duties of a groundskeeper and a tour guide to foreign visitors. The imam gave us a tour of the bell tower, allowing us to ring the bell, and then showed us the classrooms on the second floor and the museum on the first floor of the tower. According to the exhibits of the museum, the first Muslims to settle in Donglianghua were soldiers from Central Asia who had been stationed there by the first emperor of the Yuan dynasty to crush any rebellions within the newly conquered province of Yunnan. They intermarried with the local people and became involved in the lucrative tea trade with neighboring Tibet. Nearly all of the Muslims took the family name of Ma, Chinese for horse, from their occupation as merchants on the Tea Horse Road. After the museum, the imam allowed us to take photos of the interior of the mosque, the walls of which were decorated with long banners of Arabic phrases written in calligraphy, none of which the imam could read, and the darkly stained hardwood floor was covered with rows of magnificent rugs with bright floral designs. Near the entrance of the prayer hall was a board with a list of foreign Muslim donors and their donation amounts. Upon hearing the call to prayer, Muslim men wearing white caps began arriving, leaving their shoes and sandals outside as they walked barefoot into the mosque. And the imam left us to conduct the afternoon prayer, but promised to take us on a tour of the village once the prayer service had ended. Once the prayer service did finish and the imam's duties were complete, he led us on the promised tour of the village. Midway through the tour, he stopped in front of a red brick house that looked like all the others. Unlike the rest of the houses within Donglianghua, though, this house was owned by a Han Chinese family. In a hushed voice, the imam stated that the local government had repossessed the house from the former Hui family who had lived there for several generations because they had openly criticized government policy. When my translator began speaking to me in English, he told my translators to speak more softly and motioned us to keep walking. As an American citizen who has the right to freedom of speech, I couldn't imagine losing my home for simply disapproving with public policy. The next place I visited was Xi'an. Xi'an was the first and most ancient imperial capital of China and is famous for the mausoleum of the first Qin emperor and its massive terracotta army. But Xi'an is also famous for its bustling Muslim quarter, home to the great mosque and delicious Islamic Chinese cuisine and street food that make a person question whether or not they're still in China. The best time to visit and fully experience the Muslim quarter is as the sun begins to set and the neon lights begin to hum. The food vendors are out in full force every night selling everything from sticks of chowar, lamb kebabs, to slices of thick, sweet flan topped with raisins. The shopkeepers call out to each and every foreigner in English that passes by, hoping they can upsell their forged brand name products for 10 times their original price. In a country that claims to be faithful adherents of communism, the entrepreneurial spirit of capitalism is alive and well. The first night I visited the Muslim quarter, I was struck by how crowded the streets were, with pushy vendors, honking scooters, and wide-eyed tourists, Chinese and foreigner alike. To escape the madness on the street, I had dinner at a dingy-looking Muslim restaurant that just had a table open up. At the restaurant across the street, I noticed a sign stating that they did not serve halal, or meat properly prepared according to Muslim law. And then I began to question how Muslim this shopping district actually was. My waitress was a young Han woman who wore a white cap similar to the ones I had seen Hui men wear. She recommended I order their specialty, which I did, thick noodles with chunks of beef and a tasty broth. As I ate, I noticed that all the waitresses appeared to be Han, and they all wore the taqiya, or white cap, that Muslim Hui men traditionally wear as a part of their uniform. The only Muslim I could readily identify within the restaurant was the chef, discernible by her dark purple hijab or headscarf that she wore. When I left the restaurant, I began to pay closer attention to the physical features and clothing of the street vendors and shopkeepers. To my disdain, I personally observed that more than three-fourths of the businesses within the Muslim quarter were staffed with mostly Han workers in Muslim uniforms. Another trend I observed within businesses was the employment of a single Hui man or woman as a token Muslim or to presumably boost the Muslim image and credibility of their businesses among Han tourists and foreigners alike. The next day, I visited the Muslim quarter in the afternoon to avoid the throngs of tourists and view the Great Mosque of Xi'an, one of the oldest mosques in China, first constructed in the Tang Dynasty in 742 CE. The mosque complex comprised of four courtyards with gardens and arches. The Xingxin Tower, a Chinese pavilion instead of a minaret, came before the large prayer hall, which was decorated with Arabic calligraphy, the only indication that this was a mosque and not a Taoist or Chinese Buddhist temple. I interviewed a local Muslim businessman in a small souvenir shop afterwards. He was one of the few remaining Hui shopkeepers who refuses to sell his business despite repeated offers by wealthy Han businessmen. Like the imam of Donglinghua, the shopkeeper's identity will not be stated for his own safety. The shopkeeper was a middle-aged man who made most of his money from engraving seals with customers' names in Chinese and English rather than selling souvenirs like his surrounding Han neighbors. He confidently stated that about 88% of the businesses in the Muslim quarter were owned by Han Chinese, a figure that I was unable to confirm. The Han had come mostly from Beijing and Shanghai, he said, within the last 10 years to participate in the rapidly growing tourist industry of Xi'an and began buying struggling Hui businesses within the Muslim quarter. The shopkeeper said the most successful Han businesses and their owners only employed Han who spoke fluent English, which he believed was the sole reason so many Hui businesses could not compete with the Han, choosing to instead sell their business rather than to continue struggle financially. The shopkeeper also confirmed my suspicions that many of the token Muslim employees of Han businesses were exclusively to boost their image among tourists as authentically Muslim. At first glance, The Hui appear to be remarkably similar to the Han Chinese in terms of physical appearance and can only be differentiated by their white caps and headscarves. But upon further inspection, the Hui of Donghuanghua and Xi'an typically have darker skin and some men grow out their facial hair, unlike their Han counterparts, whom usually have lighter skin and whose men generally prefer to be clean-shaven. In my experience, the Hui in both Xi'an and Donghuanghua tended to be more polite towards foreigners than Han people were, and examples of these polite behavior and mannerisms include smiling when making eye contact and maintaining their calm and respectful composure when negotiating prices. Outside of the workplace, there's obvious tension between the Hui and Han in both urban and rural areas that I research. In Donghuanghua, the Han tourists did not acknowledge the presence of Hui villagers except to photograph them. Likewise, the Hui did not utter a word to the Han visitors. Even the imam appeared to look right past the Han as he took my group and I on the tour of the village. In Xi'an, the Hui only visited other Hui stores and restaurants, and I couldn't imagine what the Hui thought of the Muslim uniforms many Han employees were wearing. When I asked a shopkeeper what he thought of the Han religious and cultural appropriation of the Hui in Islam, he said, "It is like the rain. You can't stop it from raining, but you can get an umbrella." My attempt to answer my original question, how do Muslims practice their religion in a communist country, resulted in more questions than answers. I found that Muslims in China were in fact able to practice their religion freely and openly, but only after accepting certain conditions placed upon them by the Chinese government. The primary condition that both Muslims in Xi'an and Donghuanghua had to accept was the commodification of their religion for tourist purposes, which I've termed as religious tourism. Donghuanghua is marketed by the government as a historically preserved Muslim village for foreign Muslims, particularly for Muslim tourists from Indonesia and Malaysia, and for Chinese tourists, putting the Hui villagers, their homes, and their religion on display for each and every day of the year. The Muslim quarter of Xi'an, on the other hand, is quickly losing its 1,200-year-old Muslim charm and heritage as more and more Hui business owners sell their shops and restaurants to shrewd Han businessmen who are pioneering new and inventive solutions to maintain a cracking facade for tourists. The urban-rural divide was also interesting to note among Muslims in China, as I consider the Muslims in Donghuanghua to be more devout and sincere in their religious practices than their urban counterparts in Xi'an, as they actively strove to perform all five pillars of Islam, whereas Muslims in Xi'an were more concerned with the success of their businesses than fulfilling their religious duties. Another interesting thing to note is that in Donghuanghua, six people every year were allowed to go on Hajj or to go to Mecca in Saudi Arabia on approval of the government. It is clear that Islam is not only tolerated within China, but actively promoted and exploited by the government as religious tourism for economic gain. Is this exploitation of religious tourism a byproduct of China's rapidly developing economy or international relations with Muslim countries? Or is it both? Is there a more respectful way of marketing the culture and religion of the Hui to tourists that does not put them on display like animals in a zoo? How does someone begin to restore the historic and cultural character of the Muslim quarter, as most businesses are no longer owned by the Hui who once lived there? These are all important questions that require further research that I hope someone, someday, will find the answers to. Thank you.
Okay, this is the time for having questions to Edo. He has a first-hand experience.
Well, thank you for the very interesting presentation. I'm just wondering about centers of Islamic learning in China. I'm struck by the fact that one of the imams appeared not to know Arabic. So I'm wondering where these seminaries are in China and the degree to which they're controlled by the state. I imagine the imams are salaried employees of the state.
So the centers of Islamic learning, or sometimes they're referred to as madrasas, they are regulated and owned by the Chinese government, and they approve who becomes an imam. So they have to pass their test. Many of the Muslims do not speak, write, or can read Arabic at all. Those are largely on display for foreign tourists, in Donglanghua, specifically for the ones from Indonesia and Malaysia. Many of these centers for learning are surprisingly progressive in that the Chinese government has appointed numerous female imams, something which is a first, and to accommodate the separation of gender or the sexes within the mosques. Did that answer your question? They're in the major, a lot of them are in the major cities, so like the provincial capitals. One of the most, the famous one I think where the women's one is in, starts with an F, I forgot. But it's one of the ancient capitals of China. It has a long history of Muslims there.
I'm going to ask you a question, Ada. From your presentation, I can see what you demonstrate are facts. Those are facts, one after another. I can see you were talking about practice of Muslim in China isn't the easy thing. Like one of the quotes you quote from the owner of the restaurant, it's rain, that is rain. We can find an umbrella. So they practice their own religion in under umbrella. I don't know whether you remember or not. Maybe I was in part of that conversation with the Mar you were talking about in Donglianhua, because that village is the only Hui village in the area. But the village next to this village was a Chinese village. So I asked him a question. I said whether your Muslim people in your village can marry to the Han village people right next to your village. I thought the response would be no. He said, yes, of course, they are Muslim as well. But I said, you told us those people are not Muslim, they are Han. This the Mon said, in later Qing dynasty, there are some anti-Muslim movement. So half of his Muslim village people, especially young people, moved out. They found a new village, and they called themselves Han. So they are actually they call them Han, but they are not real Han. They are still Muslim. So even though this is what the question is, that possible? The case, they do not actually probably read Arabic, but they still carried up some Muslim tradition, no matter what happened in the history.
Yes, that is possible. So what she's referring to is literally across the street from the village of Donglanghua is like modern housing and a bunch of high-rise apartment buildings. And a lot of the Hui Muslims that used to live there, there would be periodic purges or massacres, especially like during the Cultural Revolution. They actually just moved across the street and adopted typical Han Chinese family names to escape persecution. But they still visit and are what you might call, they still visit the mosque, but they're what you might call closeted Muslims who do not openly admit that they are Muslim. Unlike the people who live across the street in the more ancient houses in the village.
Is there, through your study, or did you, or were you able to discover there were obviously the registered mosque? Are there the existence of unregistered mosque or activity that would be non-registered?
So you're talking about like, This isn't only for Islam in China, though. This is for other religions, such you might have heard of house churches or underground churches. There are some. They're not as widespread just because the Chinese government has been so accommodating to Muslims in China, just because they want to have good relations internationally with other countries. But in areas such as Xinjiang, which is in western China, the government has closed down a lot of mosques, and they only allow one mosque in a city of like a million people for people to pray in, because they want to try and control what the imams are preaching or what they're saying to their adherents. So there are some, but that's more in Xinjiang and other places where more the Muslim minorities are being repressed. Their culture is, their language. Yeah.
If I can answer the question also from my experience, in the Catholic Church, there is underground church because these members of the Catholic Church are loyal to the Pope, not to the communist parties. But for the Islamic people, there is no need to have an underground mosque because, as Dao said, that the government has been very accommodating. I'm coming to you for a question that you didn't really touch as we talked about the Tibetan relation with the Islamic people. I know it's a very sensitive thing because we all know in the Western world that, you know, Chinese government is not really supportive of the Tibetan independent movement or any of these actions. But however, you know, under the surface of the conflict between the communist-led Han people versus Tibetan people, there is also undersurface relation between the Hui Islam people and the Tibetan people. In fact, they have very violent conflict in the past and even today. Why you think that that's the situation that the West does not really know, but it's going on? How that serves the Chinese government with the relation one in favor, one is not in favor?
Right. So this is a very complex question. So Tibet is obviously a sensitive issue, especially in China. You don't talk about Tibet. They have a different name for it. So the Chinese government deliberately put the Hui, they settled them in Tibet on vacant land too, or in sometimes repossessed houses, deliberately in the middle of these Tibetan communities to try and divide and conquer them so it'd be easier to rule them. So the Tibetans, most Tibetans resent the Chinese government's actions in their homeland, and furthermore, when they try and colonize them, not only with other Han people, but also with different religious minorities, such as Muslims. So there have, unfortunately, been a lot of sectarian violence, a lot of violent clashes between Tibetans, who are traditionally Buddhist, and Hui Muslims. There hasn't been any lately that I've heard of, but in the early 2000s, there was a lot of problems. And this also has to do with the Tibetans agitating or pushing for greater autonomy or even independence from China.
One more thing. I want to get your impression of this. A lot of religious freedom is advocated by the government, but in reality, we all know they have to obey certain laws. That in that case, religious freedom is not really a real religious freedom. But there is a very smart way done by Chinese in many ways. Even writers like Ian Johnson, who recently published a book called The Souls of China, the emerging of the Chinese religion, said any activities, if you code it as a religious behavior, the government will say no. But if you say, oh, this is a cultural event, that you are allowed to do so. Do you agree with that kind of observation?
Yes and no. Yes, because, yeah, if you could say it's a cultural event, then they'll allow it. Insofar as, you know, it doesn't say anything bad about the Communist Party or the government. But no, because there have been many instances where minorities, they can celebrate, but they're also limited in their celebrations of their identity, of their culture, any of that. They can't go too far in expressing anything. A very vivid, violent example is in Xinjiang. I mentioned this earlier, but the Uyghurs there are actually suffering severe repression under the Chinese government. They happen to be a Turkic minority who are Muslim, and so the government, since they've been acting out, the government has labeled them as jihadis or terrorists. But in truth, the Uyghurs aren't using the Quran or any verses or anything like that to wage war against the government. They want to speak their own language, you know, dress how they want to, not wear them as uniforms on certain days because the government says so. So it's really complicated. It's really messy.
I have two questions for you. First one, see, I know you you communicated with some younger generation of Muslim, even one of them from Uyghurs, and also you communicated with some Hui in Renmin University. From your observation, is that possible? Muslim in China actually is in danger as a religion. This is the first question. Second question: Did you some like observation or comparison between the Catholic churches and the Muslims' life in China? What are the differences?
Okay, the first one was the first. Yeah, so I've spoken to a lot of young Muslims, college age. I don't know if in danger is the right word. A lot of them just aren't telling people that they're Muslim unless they know the other person. They have a clear indication that they are Muslim. Otherwise, a lot of them claim to be Han or don't even mention their religion at all. Because the Hui, they look like most Han. They dress like them. They talk like them. The only difference is their religion, the fact that they are Muslim. I was speaking with one man at Renmin University, and it was during lunch, but it was during the month of Ramadan. And he just said he wasn't hungry, so I didn't know that he was actually fasting. Then later when we were alone, he confessed that, oh yeah, you know, I'm very interested in your research because I am Muslim. And I was like, oh, and I felt horrible because I was eating in front of him and he hadn't eaten anything since sunrise. So there were other minorities who, you know, they want to claim to be Han because their minority status kind of singles them out, and sometimes they get ganged up on by other Han by being like, oh, you know, you minorities have it so easy, because there's also a college entrance exam known as a Gaokao. Minorities can get extra points added to their scores just for being a minority, which many Han don't think is fair. But in comparison, Han are, that ethnic group makes up over almost 92% of China's total population. And there are 55 other recognize ethnic groups within that country. What was the second question? The Catholic Church. Yeah. So when I was there, Christianity was almost non-existent. Where it was alive, it's strictly regulated and controlled, even more so than, you know, mosques and all the churches. They have to, if they pass a certain, if their congregation passes a certain amount of people, then a lot of them are closed down. Another interesting thing that I noted about churches, they all have to have a red cross. Their cross has to be red, as in communist red or China red. They can't be, you know, can't have Jesus on or any of that stuff on. So yeah, these churches are limited in their size, and that's why there's a lot of underground churches. Also the Catholic Church, you know, the government kind of is in charge of who they appoint, or they at least have to approve the Vatican's appointment. So there's a lot of disagreement over who gets what, especially if like a bishop doesn't agree with the government's policies, whether at the provincial, local level, or at the national level. So yeah, it's not too good.
Adil, thank you. I just have a methodology question because I think I might have missed this. Could you fill in the gaps? What methodology were you using? You call this research. So I just want to fill in that piece. In most I'm interested in, because if it's such a variety and large number, I'm curious as to how many people you spoke with and how you triangulated, yeah, or the sources there, if you wouldn't mind.
Yes, I spoke... Most people I was able to talk with were in Donglianhua, just because the people in Xi'an didn't want to talk to me, because they were like, either buy something or get out. So I didn't have a lot of success there, which is why I mentioned one of the only people who were willing to talk to me there was the shopkeeper. Otherwise, they would generally answer my questions, because I would ask them, were you able to fulfill the five pillars of Islam? Or how do you feel about the government? Simple questions like that I hope would lead to more questions along the interview. But a lot of people were unwilling to talk just because of that, in Xi'an at least. In Donglianhua, after a while, a lot more people were... That's where I interviewed, unfortunately, the majority. So it is skewed in that aspect, especially the urban-rural divide. And they're also completely different provinces, different cities, different economies even. So yeah, it's not a very good schematic of the whole country of all Muslims in China. It's a lot of people. But this, I just wanted to take these core samples, which I hoped would be better, especially in Xi'an, but they were not. And so that's what really surprised me. And I felt like a lot of my research was inconclusive because I didn't get to talk to that many people. I was hoping to have an even number of people to talk to in both Xi'an and Donglianhua, but I failed to meet that. I don't know, I need to go back there again. Try it again.
Well, and you were observing, right?
Yes, so I was observing and interviewing people.
So one piece that can happen with that is then triangulating with other observers who have written in sort of in a systematic review way. Was that something you did before, after, or not yet?
I tried. So there's not a lot written on this, period. There's one professor, his name's Gladney. He's written a lot of stuff, but his stuff is dated. So, and another problem is a lot of these things aren't actively circulated or promoted outside of China, just because there's not an interest in Islam in China at all. So there's very few things to go off of to even base my, to start my whole project off of, which was another problem I encountered, which I'm hoping more people will get interested because of the population rate there is increasing at a dramatic rate, especially among Muslims, just worldwide. They'll be the next dominant religion. And so China's actually been ahead of co-opting them into their system, which is something maybe the United States could look at.
For quickly respond your curiosity, I went to Kashgar. That's not recently. It's probably 2010. I went to Kashgar. That time was pretty like a honeymoon time period between China and the West. But Kashgar is very different. Like 98% people there are Uyghurs. They are Muslim. They look different. And when I walk on the street, I saw police. They wear not wear handgun. They wear machine gun. It's huge. So I followed them. I went with one of Uyghur's students. This Uyghur student saw me follow those police. I tried to take a photo. He grabbed me. He said, "They can shoot you if you take a photo." That was my fear. Oh, this is a place. It actually sort of like a police stay. And one of my other Uyghur students, his father was a news reporter. He persisted to give me a book as a gift. We went to his house. It's very much Muslim house. It's very beautiful. He's an up-level Muslim. He gave me a book. So I said, "Could you sign this is your book?" The whole book is about how great the Communist Party members are in their area. They contribute to this, contribute to that. So could you sign? He didn't sign. It's fine with me. But after I left the house, the son chased me. The son told me, because I'm an American, his dad is like scared to sign anything as a gift to give to American. So this is what I feel. So when Adol wants, he definitely wants to go to Kashgar. I said probably shouldn't. And we discuss over and over. Donglianhua is a replacement of Kashgar.
Yeah, my original research project, I was going to go to Urumqi, which is the capital of Xinjiang, and then I was going to go to Kashgar, which is like a former capital of the Uyghur Khanate and the Uyghur Beys and Emirs that were there, because they're dramatically different. Urumqi has been colonized and effectively rebuilt in the image of a Chinese, typical Chinese city. Kashgar is still, I don't want to say resisting, they're still very proud of their heritage, their Uyghur heritage, and maintaining that image. Unfortunately, Kashgar is like ground zero for a lot of the violence in Xinjiang, although there are a lot of other cities along the border.
According to my experience in Kashgar, they have lots of companies. Those companies are funded by Chinese money. And the top leader of the company, such as a CEO or party secretary, all of them are Han Chinese. They were signed to those companies. The second position could be the Uyghurs. Most of Uyghurs are lower position. They cannot get. None of the company is led by Uyghurs. That's why Uyghurs are unhappy.
It's one of the reasons.
Yeah, one.
Please join me in thanking our speaker.
You've been listening to a lecture program from Creighton University on Noon Forum. We've heard the first of three programs recorded at the 13th Asian Culture Week, presented annually by the Asian World Center at Creighton. Today's guest speakers were Adel Salazar, an East-West graduate student in the Asian World Center, and Maran Zhang, the director of the Asian World Center. They spoke on the topics Official Religious Policy in China and Eyewitness Reality of the Chinese Muslims Practicing Islam in Communist China. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday afternoon, April 18, 2017, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Cindy Workman, Director of Public Relations, and Marang Zhang, Director of the Asian World Center at Creighton University, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. The next program in the series will be next Monday, August 21st at 12 noon. At that time, we'll hear a talk by Richard Whitmer, Professor of Political Science at Creighton University. He'll speak on the topic Forced Federalism, Indigenous Nations, and State-Government Relations. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 600 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.